climbing windows, chopping your people up, chopping, chopping. You better hide your keys, hide your wife, hide your keys, hide your wife, hide your keys, hide your wife.
Hey, and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Today we have a crazy movie about a knife-wielding maniac, maybe not a maniac. I don't know. Greg's here to tell me all about it. Greg, go ahead. Tell us about your film. Is he crazy or not?
Oh, he's crazy, all right. Hi, my name is Greg Deliso. I made this movie called Hectic Knife with a good friend of mine named Peter Litvin, who was the producer on the movie. We co-made it together, so it's really our thing, and so the way that we delineated responsibilities was pretty evenly split too. So I directed and I shot and edited the movie myself, and then he starred in it as the main character, whose name is Hectic Knife, and that's the name of the movie. And then he was also the producer, and Pete also did the score and all the sound mixing and the ADR and all that good stuff. So that was kind of an interesting mix of job titles that we shared. But it's really the two of us doing everything. And to answer your question, yeah, I mean, look, in real life, he's crazy, and also in the movie, no, in real life, he's cool. I'm just kidding. But the character Hectic Knife is this, this vigilante kind of superhero that has magical powers that kind of make sense sometimes. And, he's sort of, he's kind of immortal in the sense that, like most of our superheroes in comic books and movies and stuff, it's like he has the classic thing of, you can kind of beat him up a ton in a fight and shoot him and stab him, and he just kind of, won't die. And then, the second he stabs another bad guy, they just die or something, So it's, he kind of absorbs all these tropes, and he's sort of made up of movie tropes, if that kind of makes sense. And everything in his universe is, too. And it's really, it's interesting with Hectic Knife because, it's got the word knife in the title, and there's lots of blood, and there's lots of, killing bad guys and stuff. And so, and especially because we're out on, we have distribution with Troma. And so, there's a lot of overlap for us sort of in the, slasher and exploitation movie scene. But I like to stress that it's definitely a comedy. Like, it's definitely supposed to be satirical. It's definitely supposed to be funny. If you come at it, looking at it with the lens of, oh, this is going to be, a scary horror movie, or even if this is going to be, some sort of traditional sort of hero story, I think, that could damage it just because, you go in hoping for something and what you get is completely different. So to me, I like to stress to people that this is like a crazy, out there, gonzo, meta, anti, whatever kind of, prefixes you want to put on it. But it's a comedy all the way through, and it was always meant to be a comedy. And, if you're squeamish about blood, then I understand, but it's definitely, it's definitely a comedy and not like a slasher or something. But I also, look, I have nothing against slashers or horrors either, and I've been really appreciative of the response that we've gotten sort of from the horror crowd. And I think especially some of those guys kind of see that, even though it's a comedy, it's still playing on some of their sort of familiar tropes as well. And also just, look, sometimes anything with a knife and a bunch of stabbing and blood is fun for everyone. So, but I don't know, man. Here, ask me some questions. I feel like I ramble. I'm long-winded anyway, so I know it's your format. But, yeah, help me out a little bit.
All good. Oh, I didn't get it. When could I have asked a question there?
I don't know. You're right. I'm too long. I go on too long, though. It's my...
Okay. Why the name Hectic Knife is my first question. Where does that come from?
There's an odd story, and I hesitate to try to even tell it because it's just, it's esoteric to, myself and some friends in a way. Basically, the obvious answer is, he's a vigilante. He's got two, steak knives, two kitchen knives, and so he's pretty hectic with them. He swings them around like a maniac, but that's kind of...
No, I don't think that's... I wouldn't accept that. No.
Hey, that's fair, because that's more just like a description of what's happening rather than the name of a character. So the only thing I can say is this. When I was in film school 12 years ago, I was 17, and this guy in my class was really excited, and he was describing the sound design for his next short, and he was like, oh, it's going to be this hectic sound design, and he was just really caught up. He was really excited about it, and we kind of took that, my little friend group, for 12 years, after, we took that as oh, that's a funny thing that happened, and it was funny when he said it. And so when I was first playing around with the earliest footage that Pete and I had shot, and he was dangling around with these knives and stuff, and I don't know, there's just something about, it literally is very similar, I'm being honest. It's very, Pete Anderson did a good job capturing this thing, this moment that you can have in Boogie Nights when he's got Dirk Diggler explaining when he comes up with his name and he says he just like sees it in these neon lights. Like there's, to me, when those two words came into my head, Hectic Knife, and they were put together and it had the right phonetic quality that just made me laugh because you coupled it with looking at Pete doing this weird knife movements and whatever he was doing. And it also did obviously describe what was happening, so it had that obvious benefit. But the, you know, I knew nobody would ever understand the esoteric connection. I wasn't like worried about that. I knew I would never, you know, no audience person's ever going to care about like our dumb friend in film school. That didn't matter. But I don't know. There was something about the phonetic thing. Like once I had applied that to the name, it was just these block letters. I couldn't avoid the idea, and it made us laugh because it just sounds so dumb. And I think then the next step was that, well, the no-brainer was, well, that if that's also the name of this person, if his name is also Hectic Knife, that's really silly and funny because it's not, I mean, it's not a name. It's like, you know, it's the same thing of like, you know, the idea that, I, you know, as everyone knows, like, you know, Peter Parker is Spider-Man, so it's not like his name is Spider-Man, or, you know, Clark Kent, that's the guy's kind of like his name, you know what I mean? But with Hectic Knife, there was no, there's no dimension. Like, he's fully just a hero in some bizarre universe. You're allowed to have the name Hectic Knife in his universe. Yet somehow, I'm sure, you know, you've seen the movie, they even comment on how stupid it is, too. So it's all sort of meant to be, you know, circular and meta, like aware of itself and stuff. But no, I think, again, it was literally just something, and I feel weird revealing this because it's a little bit like, you know, it makes me look kind of silly. But yeah, like 2-4 years ago when before the movie existed and we were still making it, like I could still be driving around and just think the name Hectic Knife and it would make me laugh to myself.
Oh, it makes me laugh. So I like it.
I thank you. I appreciate it. And look, you know, I didn't know that I never had any idea whether or not that would, you know, resonate or work with anyone else or anything, but as long as it made me laugh and it seemed to make Pete laugh and a couple of our friends, like, I felt like I was onto enough to at least keep it. And again, doubling it with the character name just made so much sense. So that's where that comes from, man. Yeah.
Okay, we haven't got through a film yet. I still have more questions. Why black and white? Just a financial issue?
No, not financial at all. Actually, very purposeful because I felt like, couple things. Two things. So, I was using a Panasonic DVX 100B, which is really now kind of in movie history. It's a benchmark camera. It was the first major 24B camera. And when you look at movie history now, and obviously, you know, it's kind of interesting. Like you know, we have these film cameras like Panavision and Bolex and Aeroflex and blah blah blah, and they're all shooting on film. And it's this, you know, process of a you know, hard technology and analog technology. And then we're switching over to these electronic ones and zeros, and so they had a lot of trouble with tape adjusting the quality. So it's like all of a sudden there's this boon in movie history where there's like an exponential amount of more movies created in a year, but they all look like way lower quality than, you know, they did 10 years ago because everybody was using, you know, Panavision and 35. So there's this weird jump, and now we're kind of, you know, it took 20, 30 years, but we're like catching up, and it's kind of, you know, now it's all kind of out the window, and there's stragglers that are still using film and this and that. Well, at the time that I bought the Panasonic DVX, I mean, this is like 2005 or 6, and the camera had only been around for a couple years, and it was the hot camera, and it was also like the camera that MTV was shooting all its original content on. I mean, the show Arrested Development was shot on the DVX, the documentary Jesus Camp. We're talking about, you know, these hot documentaries like Jesus Camp were being shot on the Panasonic DVX, and also, like I said, everything from MTV. You know, this is in a tiny pocket of movie history in the mid-2000s before HD came about, because the next wave of the camera that I shot Hectic Knife, which was the HVX, which was the HD version of the camera that I used. But to go back to your black and white question, so the DVX natively shoots in 4:3, so I knew that I had two things happening. I had a Kubrick ratio that he liked to use, and then I also had the obvious ratio of the old TVs, you know, that square box, and it was also the ratio of, like, say, a lot of movies in the 50s and before, because that was, you know, that was just their shape. So with that boxy shape, I felt like, okay, this is much more like a comic book cartoony style thing. Like, we're boxed in. We're not witnessing like the grandeur of, you know, the Hectic Knife City and in all its glory of Gotham City, we're boxed into a very bizarre small universe that contained within it has these very bizarre notes, like the, you know, the straight person of the movie being Hectic Knife, you know, he's a really bizarre character, but he's also kind of the straight person in his own story, because all the other characters are really crazier and weirder. So to me, the boxed-in quality of the 4-3 that was Agents of the DBX, and by upping the contrast and doing the black and white, the look was very, very much mimicked directly after Darren Aronofsky's Pi, which was shot on a Tri-X reversal stock, which is a film stock on 16mm that gives you this really high contrast look. It's not the same as like a regular film stock where what you're getting is you know, sort of very flat and a lot of gray notes. You're just getting a lot of crushed blacks and a lot of bright whites. So that look was very much intentional, and it was designed around that. But I felt that the high contrast look added to that sort of, if you want to say, like Sin City, Frank Miller as a sort of direct reference, but really more of like, you know, what's happening here, it has few dimensions. It's crazy. You're witnessing a window into this bizarre universe. And if I use color, all of a sudden everybody's going to be, you know, talking about the yellow shirt that this guy wore, or whether or not the blues, you know, looked enough like blue. And then when you get to the scenes in Hectic Knife that are actually in color, I kind of cringe a little bit because, first of all, you know, the black and white really covers up a lot of the DBX's archaic-looking flaws. I mean, Hectic Knife was shot on tape, so we're talking about a movie that was shot for only $15,000 on tape, where, you know, next to these big, you know, tens of millions of dollars, you know, still shot on film or shot on HD or 4K or 8K or whatever it is, and I'm trying to kind of compete with those guys. So it has to have some sort of a look that's going to make up for the fact that when it's just regular color, you're going to get, you know, pixelation in there, and you're gonna, I mean, it looks like it's on tape, you know, it's not gonna blow up well to Blu-ray and all those kind of things. So in competing with that, the black and white really helped me give it like a comic book style, an old movie feel, all those things. And I'll also say that all of the grain in the Hectic Knife is all natural. I never added any effects in post to give it like a fake, you know, 70s look or a fake 80s look. It was natural, and how I did that was I upped the gain on the camera, and for all these tech people that might know about cameras and stuff, the gain is something that if you're like in a low light situation and you have a digital camera, you basically up the gain, and the gain allows as much light as it possibly can into the camera to get you an image at all. But as we all know, generally when you're shooting in those conditions, there's a lot of grain because it's fighting to get that light in there, and it's picking up that grain. So for me, even when we were outside, I just had that gain all the way up, and so there would be a little tiny bit of fight for the camera to kind of get that grain. So all the grain that you're seeing is all totally natural. It's right on the tape. I didn't have to do anything. The only thing I did have to do was, you know, adjust it. You know, I shot it in color, obviously, so you make it all black and white first, and then from there you kind of adjust the contrast as you go and stuff. But that was the idea. And also, you know, to make a colorized version, it sort of is possible, although some scenes are just, like, completely blue because I never white balanced because I didn't have to. But I'd say, I don't know, roughly half the movie would be, like, just pressing a couple buttons and turning off the black and white, and you get this color version that would be really kind of bizarre looking. Sometimes on Twitter, I release like a still image that was never made black and white, so you still see everything in its full color, and it looks kind of odd and interesting because you're just like seeing it in this weird reality. So that's fun. But yeah, that's the idea behind the black and white.
Okay. And we still haven't got your movie, just so you know. You're half an hour in, no movie yet. For Jammy, we miss you. Who's Jammy?
That was Pete's Bearded Dragon. Just a, you know, pet that he had for a long time, and, you know, fortunately she passed away while we were making the movie, so that's just that. It's just a simple dedication, yeah.
I figured as much, but I had to ask, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, the woman smoking, I started a film a while ago, so I'm going to have to go through my notes, and I liked her look. I liked the look of all the characters in the film.
Oh, thanks.
So I thought they were very interesting.
Thank you.
And Rico's voice is insane.
Rico, I think, was done by me and Pete. In fact, in the very beginning, you know, so much of the movie is ADR. For anyone who doesn't know, ADR stands for additional dialogue recording. And so that means that if you're, like, on set and the sound that you record on set, the quality is low because there's background noise or, you know, whatever's happening in the background. you basically just go into a studio with your actors and you re-record the dialogue. Well, we did that for about 80% of Hectic Knife, and so the opening voices that you hear, like, that's not even that same girl's voice, that's a different actress doing her ADR, and then when she turns around and screams, it's actually me screaming, because I never got the loudness of the scream, the real guttural, terrified scream that I wanted for the beginning, so I was just like, well, I'll just do it. So I did my best high pitch screaming. So that's actually me that you hear in there doing that. But yeah, Rico, I think, was, you know, just a voice, because the actor that played the junkie guy that comes out, he's a friend of ours. His name's Jesse. He's not an actor. He's just a good friend. He also happened to do our Foley art, and he also did some music for the movie. He that track that sounds like Slayer, I think it's him playing drums on there, and he did the recording for that and stuff. But no, he's just like a guy that he was one of our technicians. He did really great work on the movie. He wasn't an actor though. But I don't think that's his voice either saying Rico. It's definitely me and Pete, you know, doing the weird Rico.
It's good. It's good. Where did you find the alley?
Detroit. So Pete and I are both from the northern, faraway suburbs of Detroit proper. But, you know, as you get older, you start exploring the kind of city that you live above. So we would go down there. And interesting footnote. So the alley and all those little locations in the very beginning and the montage that come right after that, those are real, like, you know, Detroit, urban, gritty spots. In fact, when we were there, it's not as though they were dangerous. But the building that you see when it pans down, that's actually the old headquarters of the Purple Gang, which was the Jewish mafia that had a big stronghold. This was back in, like, the 50s and 60s or something, but it was the Purple Gang was a very well-known crime syndicate that ran a lot of Detroit, and that's their old building. So we're in some pretty actual, you know, tough old gritty Detroit spots for sure. It was all shot in Brooklyn and Detroit.
Now I got a note on Hectic Knife business cards. He's doing the best he can.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, it was a weird joke. You know, there's jokes like that we almost abandoned, really, because we have one thing where he just has a business card and it's got pictures of knives all over it and stuff, but then it just is never addressed again. But then, see, the bad guy has a business card too, which is odd. He has his henchmen tuck them into their shirts. So, I don't know.
The sound mix done after the film, I did make a note on that. And where did the character ideas come from? I wrote comic books.
I've been asked this a little bit about how we wrote it and stuff, and so to, yeah, as far as the characters, it's obviously all, you know, character-driven, as you're picking up on, in the sense that, you know, we're not plot-heavy, of course, but also, you know, we're really depending on kind of the oddness of the characters themselves to kind of make the jokes work and make it make sense and everything. There was never any script in the sense of, when Pete and I never sat down and, like, wrote from page 0 to page 100, and then that was done, and then we had a document, and then we auditioned people. That's not how it worked. What we did instead was Pete and I were just kind of fooling around creating these short films on our own, and none of them had any real hook in the sense that, like, we made one called Garlic Bag, and it's literally just him dressed up in a princess costume, and there's a bag of garlic hanging in front of him, and he just makes weird noises and stuff, and that's it for, like, 5 minutes. So there's really nothing you can do with that. Like, it was, you know, it amused us, and it was just goofing around, and it was really for each other and for our friends. But, like, you can't, you know, to develop that into a story or any larger thing really doesn't make sense. So Hectic was the first thing that of these little shorts that we had made that we felt like we could expand. But, again, once we made the decision to kind of make it into a movie, we never sat down and started writing a script. What we did instead was we were both, you know, freelancing as artists in New York, basically. So Pete was freelancing as a musician and a producer, engineer for other artists. So he would, you know, he'd have rappers coming into his bedroom, and then they would record, and he would produce that, and that's how he was making a living. And so that's how he basically financed the beginning of our venture of making Hectic with that money. Like, all that, those scenes in the movie where people are flashing, like, giant wads of money, you know, that was essentially our budget, but also that was, like, Pete's money that he was saving from making all this, you know, doing this work with these rappers and these pop artists and stuff. And again, this is back in, like, 2009 or 10 or so, and he's doing really well. He made his little own business there. And I was doing the same thing. I wasn't doing as well as him, but I was freelancing in the film industry, so I was making music videos for, like, a couple $100 a pop. You know, I was doing short documentaries. I was really, you know, cutting stuff. I was doing anything I could under the sun, making, like, a grand or two a month in New York City, just doing freelance stuff. So I was living in Pete's bedroom. Or I'm sorry, not his bedroom, his living room. And that was Link's bedroom. So if you see the movie, like, the little bed that Link lays down on, that was my actual bed in real life. And there was no fourth wall in reality because it was just an open living room that I was living in. And that's how I was getting by, and that's how Pete was getting by, you know, doing our stuff. But going back to the writing process, because we both had schedules where, you know, we didn't have neither one of us had a 9-to-5, but we also both were beholden to, like, our clients and our client schedules and stuff like that. We decided to shoot every Monday. So for 15 weeks in a row, we shot on Mondays, and the way it would work was on Wednesday, Pete and I would walk around our neighborhood, which was Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and this was, you know, the perfect time to do it. It was like spring, summer, really nice out, and we're just walking around. Pete had a little phone recorder or something, and we would talk to each other, and we basically would walk around for like 2 or 3 hours and have a lot of fun just pitching each other ideas. So Pete would say, like, dude, I don't know, I think, like, Hectic should have a really annoying roommate, and that became Link. I would say, like, well, his name should be Link, and then he'd laugh, and then it'd be like, okay. And then we'd just start coming up with, like, well, how does he annoy him? Like, what's annoying about him? And then we'd just be like, well, he'd be, like, doing push-ups, and, you know, the guy would come in and say a bunch of stuff about whatever. Like, we'd just be pitching these ideas to each other, and that's where we came up with, like, the idea of the girlfriend that's stealing from him, or, you know, Piggly Doctor, the villain that blows up kids' heads. And it was just coming out of these conversations. So every Friday, Pete, the producer, he would then transcribe our notes and turn it into what, you know, in the filmmaking world, and what I would basically call a hybrid between a call sheet and a shooting script, which is a shooting script, as you know, is you take sections of the actual script and you turn that into sort of what you're going to produce for the next week's shoot. However, the call sheet is also this thing that you have where it's like a document for next day's shoot. So, you know, this has the list of props and what time everybody has to show up and, you know, what departments are needed and the costumes and all that stuff, whatever they need for that day, right? So he would kind of create a couple-page document that was both of those, and that would be what we would use to then produce Monday's shoot. And we never had more – see, it's listed on IMDb as a 15,000-hour budget. You know, the reality is that it's probably even more of about a $30,000 to $50,000 venture all in all, including, you know, all the promotion and all the, you know, things like that. Included, but the budget for the movie itself was probably more around $20,000 to $25,000, and it was spread out between the two of us out of our pockets and our dad's pockets, you know, between over the course of 8 years. So each of us spent like $2,000 a year. But the thing I want to make clear is we never had an operating budget of more than, say, like $1,000 at a time. So, like, it was never like, oh, we got $20,000 and we're just going to kind of like shoot for 15 days and be comfortable and do all that. It was like, no, we have like, you know, a couple grand. We're going to shoot on Monday. We're going to get as much done as we can. But I will say this, though, is that for as sort of out there and bizarre, and a lot of people ask us, like, well, how much of it was improv and all that kind of stuff. I will say Pete and I actually wrote the whole thing. I mean, it's all written. You know, there's little tiny, tiny moments that I can see that are improv, but it was really, I mean, despite the fact that there is no script from page zero to 100, like, we wrote the whole thing, and also it follows pretty much to a T, like, that writing process and that craft. So it's interesting, like, the way that it was all put together, but that kind of, you know, that character focus, it's like, that's the reason why those characters were so important and why we were, you know, either depending on the acting skills or lack of acting skills from some of our cast was because we weren't writing, like, the next great American plot. And we weren't also ever trying to write, you know, the next, like, great American comic book superhero story. It was more, what's the funniest thing that we can do with this and how can we sort of shape it? And to add to it a little more, you know, the way that I kind of describe it is that Pete is, like, the outsider artist. Like, he would come in with just the most bizarre ideas. Like, to me, I would be thinking, like, okay, this scene is going to be, you know, the fight that leads up to the climax, and we got these weird thug characters in a hallway, blah, blah. But then all of a sudden, Pete would be like, well, no, we have to have, like, a dozen bagels, and that has to be, like, the scene. And I would be like, well, how do you make this, you know, idea that is completely bizarre and random and absurd and out there and means nothing, you funnel that absurdity through something that could possibly make sense. So that was sort of the idea.
Okay, we're back. We're just having a weird sound problem tonight. I'm sorry about that. Killing the kids with dynamite, you got any flack about that?
No, that was, why, hey, man, I wish. No, If anyone's ever seen John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, there's a great scene in there where there's an ice cream truck and his kids go up to it and they get killed.
Yep.
And when you watch it, it's you really get this sense of, oh, wow, you know, that's something that they kind of had the guts to do back then that they wouldn't do now. And look, I'm not trying to be Mr. like, oh, PC is dumb. And like, I'm not, you know, I don't have any, you know, I'm not, I don't, I like the evolution of language and I'm glad that we're not, you know, using, you know, racial slurs and stuff like that in common language anymore. And I think that PC culture is a good thing. And the backlash to it, I think, is a lot of laziness. But that said, when you do watch something that's, that has a little bit of that visceral kind of raw quality, like in an Assault on Precinct 13 scene, there is a little moment of like, wow, they really wouldn't do something like that nowadays. It's very kind of edgy and it's arresting. It's very arresting. And to me, you know, along that vein, it was like the idea of the scene was inspired in that same way. And then I thought, you know, in a joking sense, well, what's the easiest way to like convince an audience that someone is the villain? Well, why don't we just have them like murder kids? You know, it's like, well, you know, for no reason, you know, it's just like, it's kind of down to like, you know, conflict and storytelling, not even 101, but like, you know, class 99, like below 101, just like, you know, show the villain like holding a hammer over some puppies and everyone will know that he's evil. It's just kind of like obvious, but that became the joke of it too. It's like, If you can appreciate Peggy Knight, you obviously can appreciate the idea that, you know, exposition is kind of this funny idea and how do you set up information and, you know, the way that most movies and stories set up information is tends to be silly and funny. So to me, again, it's like, well, you're trying to set up, you know, the bad guy. How do I say it like this? Like, you set up Hectic Knife, and he's the kind of person that'll just, like, help a struggling, you know, fly or bee or whatever it is on the street corner by just helping them. And then you show Piggly, and he's, you know, just killing children for no reason in this crazy way. So it's just, you know, in a very cartoonish level, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And I also, it's in another sense, it's also a reaction to, like, you know, when I was a kid, the villains were clear. Darth Vader was the villain. It was obvious. He wore all black, and he was really mean to people and choking dudes out from, you know, telepathy. Nowadays, there's this, like, blurred line where, you know, the villain has all these redeeming qualities and the good guy is all conflicted and all this stuff. And I don't really understand that to me. Like, when I look at the world and I see, you know, Trump or whatever, it's like, that looks like a villain to me. It's pretty clear. It's not – it doesn't really – you know, the black and white blurred lines of nowadays seem odd to me, where there's, like, this whole thing of, like, we're not allowed to have these classic heroes and villains because they're, like, passe or something like that. And I don't really understand that, and Hectic Knife is a bit of a reaction to that, I think, in that way. But, again, everything I just said sounds insanely pretentious and silly, because if you look at Hectic Knife, it's, you know, look, it's supposed to be, like, a silly, you know, drinking comedy movie where your buddies, you know, take a shot every time someone says bagels. You know, it's supposed to be for fun. You know, it's supposed to be goofy. So I don't mean to wax all crazy, but there are notes of that inside that, and that's kind of where that stuff comes from, I guess.
Where did the prop for the money box come from? Hectic's money.
I don't have any idea. It was just a tin box.
I loved it.
You know, we've never gotten anybody asked that before, and it was really just a tin box. You know, the idea to have the button inside, and just the button was mine. And then Pete, you know, every time you saw it, I love it. Every time you see, like, you know, what it'll say, like, Hectic's money box or comics or something written out, that's always Pete's handwriting, and I just think his handwriting is so funny. It just, like, has that kind of childish look to it, and it's, you know, whatever, but the tin box, I don't know. I will tell you this, though, that what I had a lot of fun doing was, like, you know, when you make a movie, you replace all the sound effects and stuff, and so, of course, like, when he sets the box down and you hear that tinny little rattle, like, that was replaced. It's not the same box. It's a whole different thing. It's not even the original one, and, you know, it's louder than it would have been and up in the mix. And so, like, I'm really fascinated by all that stuff and how much it helps movies, but that's cool, man. We never got any comments on the tin box.
Oh, well, I enjoyed it, so I thought it was great. Where did the girl that played his girlfriend come from? They kept stealing his money.
Yeah, so she is this extremely talented actress named Georgia Cage Height. I'm not sure how to say it. I feel bad. She's Australian, which is why I don't exactly know how to pronounce it. But her name's Georgia Height or Hage or something. You can look it up, though. Georgia, obviously. Extremely talented, though. She's actually absolutely brilliant and really, you know, obviously going through all the accents and all that stuff, we certainly get a lot of comments on that. But, you know, she brought a lot of, you know, comedy to it and a lot of professionalism to all of her scenes that she really went above and beyond. She was, you know, she's one of the few really kind of...
Continue. I don't know what's going on tonight. Go on about the girl.
Oh, man. Hey, I apologize. No, so Georgia, who played, you know, Franny, and really her both, and I should say include too, you know, Tracy Ann Wolfe, who plays Porch. The two of them really brought a lot of professionalism. Oh, seeing in your face.
Keep going. I'm going to apologize to my listeners. They keep popping up saying there's a sample rate issue, and I don't know what it is.
All right, I'd like to say to the listeners right now, this is Director Greg Galiso. I apologize. I'm sure I'm doing something wrong to the technical process of this thing and cursing this great podcast.
It's all right. Just keep going. I just keep hitting the button. He can continue. We're fine. Go.
Yeah, so Georgia and Tracy, who play, you know, Franny Glooper and Porch, both of them brought a huge level of professionalism to this whole thing that we really didn't get from a lot of other actors. What I'm really proud of is that, like, you know, when we pair together J.J. Bryant, who plays Piggly Doctor, with Tracy, who plays Porch, you know, J.J. had never been on camera before in his life, and Tracy had been in a bunch of stuff. And so when you see them together, I never got a sense that people could tell, like, in the world, meaning that, like, I always thought that Tracy was good enough that she brought J.J. up to his level, and he was good enough on his own naturally that he could play up. And the way I always like sort of describe it is like JJ, there's a great moment somewhere in the movie later on near the bagel scene where JJ gives this little speech to the camera. But if you watch Tracy and sort of on the other side of the frame, she's really like in it. She's totally in the pocket and doing funny stuff and has a funny face that's totally like in character and brilliant. And that's the kind of professionalism that I would get from people like Georgia and from her that had been in a lot of things before and really knew how to like hit their marks and say their stuff. But then you would pair it like, so for example, same as JJ, John Munnally, who plays Link, he had also never been in anything before. And so coupling him with someone like Georgia, it really helped us because, you know, like in the part where she is just going through all of her names over and over, you know, it's all supported by John being able to just silently stand there and react and keep reacting and sitting, you know, there's got to be the straight person in the scene working. And then, of course, when I pan the camera over, they actually continue in this whole little bit. And, you know, in those little moments, I like to say about how, like, the actors kind of took over directing because that's a tiny pocket of the movie that was improvised is that little moment. And Georgia's really taking over because, you know, she knows that John doesn't have as much experience, so she knows to, like, not talk over his lines and, you know, give him the yes ands and sort of give him the stuff that's going to keep it going and make jokes. Like, she's using all that stuff at once, whereas John is just, like, you know, never been on camera before, so he's relying on his raw talent, and they're making it work. And to me, I never looked at, like, that moment or other moments, like, similar. I never saw a thing where you could tell that, like, one actor was not professional and the other one was. They looked on an equal paring to me, and I mean that as a compliment to on all sides, because they all come off great.
Well, before we run out of time, we're almost to your hour, so I apologize. So I'm just, because you talk a lot, which is fabulous.
I do.
So.
I'm willing to apologize.
No, it's all good. I had more questions, but we don't need them. I think you've answered a lot, so I just want to get your fun questions before we run. Okay, I apologize again to our listeners for technical difficulties. Hopefully I fixed it. Is there going to be a Hectic Knife 2? Because you said there should be.
There should be, and there should be a third one. There's a script for the second one. We essentially, you know, Pete and I, when we had the original vision, we thought of three movies, but we hadn't thought of what the other two would be. At this point, what I can tell you is that the second one is a space adventure, and there's a 150-page script for that. And then the third one, I have maybe about 20 or so pages on that, and that is would be like a Hollywood farce where Hollywood, like, tells the Hectic Knife story. So imagine, you know, the last scene of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but, like, kind of an entire movie with a bunch of subplots happening and stuff. So, yes, to answer your question, yes, but whether or not those will, you know, exist in the near future or whatever, there's really no idea. I mean, Pete and I are kind of doing our own things. You know, after 8 years of working on this one thing, we're kind of happy to explore other stuff. You know, he's doing his music. I'm making, you know, I have other movies happening and things like that. So, but, yeah, hopefully, you know, we'll get down to it and sometime in the next, you know, decade or so, we'll get to the second one.
Good news. I fixed our technical difficulties. There's no more issues.
Cool.
Okay, well, you got about 13 minutes left. I apologize because I only have so much space on the website to put these up. So, yeah. Favorite movie?
Signs.
Signs? Really?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, man. Yeah.
What a bizarre...
I mean, top five if you want to hear.
Yeah, I want to hear the other ones because Signs is number one. I got to hear the next four.
These are not in any order, okay? So don't hold me to that. But Signs, Raising Arizona, Back to the Future, American Movie, and the Paradise Lost trilogy of documentaries, which I'm really forced to just kind of have it be one thing of like whatever 7 hours of content or more, or 9 hours, however long it is. But that it's hard to break those up, and I'll also include Back to the Future 1 and 2. But yeah, Signs, American Movie, Raising Arizona, Back to the Future 1 and 2, and the Paradise Lost documentaries. And if I had to go a little further, I'd say the first three Indiana Jones movies and The Burbs and Forrest Gump.
And probably
Ghostbusters 1. But yeah, man, Signs kind of takes the cake, man. To me, it's you know, you sort of heard what I listed below there, right? Or not below, but with those, and they're all kind of comedy dramas, you know, that kind of style, very mainstream, etc. For me, Signs, you know, despite the fact that Mel Gibson is crazy, and despite the whole, all the arguments that people want to make about it, about like the twist and blah blah blah, to me, it fulfills all categories beyond anything. It's actually, if you look at it in one context, it's a pretty hilarious comedy that even has cameos from like, legendary meta, you know, awesome, not even meta, just comedians like Michael Showalter that are in it. Plus, it's filled with hilarious jokes of all kinds, from slapstick all the way through to weird, you know, verbal stuff. It's brilliantly funny all around. Then in a scary like tension level, you know, I put it up there with the best movies ever made as far as its use of tension and sort of dramatic tension and fear. There's jump scares that work as well as any jump scare movie history, but there's also great moments of tension that are really gripping and really scary. But then what we all sort of know about it, of those of us that appreciate the movie the most, is that at the heart of it, it's really just a small independent drama that could be made for about $100,000 about a family. And really, when they're all knitted together in a way that only Shyamalan could do when he was like 35 and made this amazing thing in Hollywood, is what's interesting is that you take a movie that really, again, could be made very easily for like $100,000 in a shack with nothing, but you ingest, you know, or not, you fucking inject, you know, $70 million of budget into that, right? So you're now allowed to afford Mel Gibson and Joaquin Phoenix and Cherry Jones and, you know, the best DP in the world, Tak Fujimoto and all this stuff. So now all of a sudden you've elevated this, like, small drama material to, like, the highest of all time. And what you're left with is this amazing genre-bending piece because, like I said, contained within it are some of the most brilliant, hilarious jokes in movie history, but also some of the best jump scares. But it's inside a movie that's really a drama. And so for the last 30 minutes of the movie, I can basically just, like, put it on and weep endlessly at the amazing drama that's been knitted together. But at the same time, in between the weeping, you're scared and you're tense and you don't, you know, you're on the edge of your seat as much as you are at the end of Back to the Future, which is, you know, an amazing movie that does the same thing. It's genre bent. It's hilarious. Yet it's also a thriller and a science fiction teen comedy. I mean, so for me, you know, I think genre bending is sort of my favorite place to be in, and I love movies like The Burbs or Forrest Gump or Field of Dreams where, you know, you could sort of label them a few different genres and actually be fairly accurate. I mean, are they comedies? They're not really comedies at all, but they're sort of they rely on jokes a lot. You know, they're essentially just dramas, which is a word that's almost meaningless because any narrative is a drama in a certain sense. So, yeah, I don't know. But Signs, to me, crystallizes, like, all movies. It's doing everything on the highest levels.
I would give you more questions, but you're going to go over your hour, and it's going to screw up on my site, so I'm not giving you any more other than one.
Okay.
Is Hectic Knife getting a DVD release? What have you done with Hectic Knife? What are you doing with it? What's the plan?
Oh, man, hey, thank you so much for asking. So Hectic Knife is available on Blu-ray. You can go on Amazon, and you can buy it on Blu-ray. The Blu-ray has two commentaries on it, one with me and Pete, and then one with some of the actors. It's got a bunch of deleted scenes. It's got there's actually tons of features on it. It's really cool. The Blu-ray should be available pretty much internationally, but, you know, as far as regions go, so, like, if you're in Europe or something, I'm not exactly sure. You got to get a region-free player. But, yeah, then it's also on special edition DVD. There's 1,000 of those that were printed. We probably only have a couple hundred left, left because they've been sold or given away. Then it's on special edition VHS. There's only going to be 100 of those available in a first run. But we've actually pre-sold already about 25 of them, and if we sell out fast enough, we'll do a second run. It's really just based on economics. It's really, honestly, at this point in our technology time, it's about me personally being able to track down blank tape because it's just so scarce. But we're doing well with that. And then it's also streaming. So if you have Amazon Prime, it's on Amazon Prime. If you don't have Amazon Prime, you can still rent it for like $3 on Amazon Prime. And, it's also in the torrent, black market. So if, you know, I don't know anything about that stuff and I'm not allowed to because I have distribution and with Troma and it's a FBI federal blah, blah. But yeah, you can find it literally anywhere from DVD, VHS, Blu-ray, streaming and on the black market.
Well, I'm glad we got to find a hookup. Of course, we had to have technical difficulties. It just makes our life the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I apologize. I really do apologize for the previous delays and everything, too, man. It's been
tricky. Don't worry about it. It's all good. Thank you for your time. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.